thank you all very, very much. I was just with Governor Branstad, who said that he had a great time over here this morning, and he was reminding me that when he and I first worked on this, it's hard to believe, 27 years ago, that we were talking about it as gasohol, and that it gradually evolved. We voted on it in 84 and 85, and then when I was Speaker in 98, as some of you know, we ended up in a situation where actually working with Senator Grassley as Speaker, I was able to appoint Jim Nussle to chair the House part of a conference committee, which dramatically extended and strengthened the incentives for American renewable fuels. I got into this from two very different backgrounds. One was I taught environmental studies at West Georgia College and was the coordinator of environmental studies. So I had a real interest in the environment and in finding renewable fuels and in response to the oil shock of the 1970s, looking for ways to increase American energy production. And the other was that my dad was a career soldier, spent 27 years in the infantry in the U.S. Army, and so I had a very deep national security interest. And after the oil shock of the 1970s, it seemed to me that we were utterly foolish as a country to be sending hundreds of billions of dollars overseas to finance people who don't necessarily like us, some of whom have recently proven they'd like to kill us. And I think as Jim Woolsey, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency under President Clinton, says, it's fairly foolish to finance your enemies. And yet, in many ways, that's what we do when we buy lots of foreign oil, particularly from the Middle East. And with the rise of China and India, the pressure to buy oil and the pressure to get energy on the planet is going to go up, not down. Just as, by the way, the pressure to get higher and higher quality of food goes up, because as people get more successful, they go up the protein ladder, and they want more and more complex foods that are more difficult to raise and cost more money. So we're in a very interesting moment in time. And I want to take this day to talk very briefly about where I think we're at historically, to talk just briefly about what I hope the president will say tonight in the State of the Union, and then to offer you a fairly bold proposal for the future. Let me say, first of all, it is clear to me that we need an American energy plan that is designed for good environmental reasons, designed for good economic reasons, and designed for good national security reasons. If we kept $400 billion a year at home that is currently going out of the United States to buy energy, we would be dramatically better off. And frankly, I would rather have the next building boom in Des Moines than in Dubai. And so I think we ought to have a policy that focuses on that. And to be clear, I'm for all American energy. I mean, I am for oil where appropriate, natural gas where appropriate, nuclear where appropriate, wind where appropriate, solar where appropriate, and I'm for renewable fuels, and I'm for coal. We have more coal than Saudi Arabia has oil. So I'm for looking around and figuring out what's the maximum way to get American energy, to create American jobs, to make Americans wealthier, and to strengthen American national security. I think that's the starting point. Second, we are at the edge of what Dr. Andy von Eschenbach, who was the head of the Food and Drug Administration and the head of the National Cancer Institute, calls the age of the life sciences. And you can see this some if you go up and you talk to people at Iowa State about what they're doing, for example, in renewable fuels. You can see it if you go to the University of Iowa and look at what they're doing in terms of healthcare. We're going to get breakthroughs in the next 20 or 25 years that are going to be amazing. And Iowa is one of the best positioned places in the world to be involved in a biological revolution, because you have enormous productive capacity here. You know, God has blessed you with extraordinarily fertile soil, with exactly the right levels of rain and temperature, and your capacity to produce is literally unrivaled anywhere in the world. Ukraine is a distant second, but no place else is comparable to what you can produce. And so you have the potential to use this biological revolution in many, many ways. And to do that, we need to change the attitude and the psychology of the United States government. We've got to move towards a strategy that wants to accelerate new ideas, accelerate new development, accelerate the ability to use our knowledge and translate that knowledge into better health, better food production, better energy production, better materials production. And you'll be amazed. Remember that in 1939 or 40, Henry Ford actually built a car that used soybean, because back then it wasn't clear that plastic would come out of petroleum, and there was a fair thought that a plastic-like material would come out of soybeans. I was just yesterday with somebody from Bio who was telling me that there's a company which now has a bacteria which produces a plastic-like substance as a byproduct, and they're literally on the edge of being able to grow the plastic you use in water bottles so it'd be totally biodegradable. So you'd have no problem, for example, in the ocean with plastic being around for 50 or 100 or 200 years. I mean, these kind of things sound like science fiction, but those of you who keep track of them or who go visit folks who are doing research know they're not science fiction. We're going to have, and this is why the people who talk about food versus fuel are just plain, flat wrong. It is factually untrue. If anybody has created a problem with food on the planet, it is the European opposition to scientifically developed food, and the Europeans have been prepared to subject poor people in Africa and poor people in Asia to using obsolete seed products in order to intellectually feel superior while poor people have suffered. But the fact is, if you go to Pioneer Seed, or if you go to Monsanto or any other major developer, our capacity, and this is nothing new. I mean, when people who are intellectually opposed to using genetically modified organisms, you ought to show them corn as it was developed in Mexico 1,500 years ago. You couldn't eat it. It was the size of your little finger. George Washington imported a new breed of Spanish sheep in order to improve his flock. We have been working at improving food production for most of modern human history. And the truth is, if the Europeans had gotten out of the way, favored the poor over ideology, and encouraged the development of new kinds of crops, you would today have a surplus of food worldwide. The second big problem with food production, frankly, is kleptomaniac dictators like Zimbabwe, who make it so dangerous to be a farmer and so dangerous to be productive that people just quit producing. So if the dictatorships weren't discouraging production and the Europeans weren't discouraging modernity, you would have literally more food on the planet than you could deal with. And we know this is true because in the industrial world, that's what happens. The Europeans have a butter mountain. So when people come to me, and I feel this very deeply, we have had a problem of farm income back to the 1890s and 1880s. And the fact is that every time farmers start to do well, somebody starts to attack them. And it makes no sense. If you take the current price of corn and you realize that the diesel fuel to carry the box of cornflakes to market is three times the cost of the corn that's in the box of cornflakes. So why are we attacking the farmers for being productive? And the fact is, if you look at ethanol production, you're getting both ethanol and food stock out of exactly the same bushel. Because we're more and more sophisticated about how to do this. And as productivity goes up over the next 10 or 15 years, we're going to want to have increased production of biofuels, not decreased, because we're going to be able to meet both the world's food needs and increasingly help the world meet its fuel needs by using modern science and modern technology. And frankly, the other thing I find infuriating about the big city attacks is this is one industry which brings high-paying jobs and highly skilled people back to rural America, and there are now counties where the first or second largest taxpayer and employer in the county is in fact producing biofuels, and I think that's a good thing for rural America. It is great to have jobs that our young people can go to so they can stay at home if they want to and have a good job being productive, earning a good living and doing something they find interesting. And I find it distressing sometimes when folks in big cities decide they will dictate on their terms, having ridden the mass transit down to the office that they walk to, that they will then decide what should happen to people in rural America. And it usually means people in rural America don't do as well. It's just plain fact. So now you have the production of biofuel. And by the way, this matters in Georgia too. Remember, in Georgia we don't exactly use corn for biofuels, but we have this enormously rapidly growing thing called pine trees. And we're very happy as a byproduct of other kinds of activities with pine trees to also be getting involved in the biofuel business. And all around America, there are new opportunities. So let me just turn to where we are and where we need to go. The biggest single need in getting America to be capable of providing its own fuel, and this is direct from the Director of Central Intelligence, Jim Woolsey, and from other folks, is to maximize the development of flex fuel cars. there is zero reason for the auto manufacturers not to produce flex fuel cars, and there's zero reason to tolerate their resistance. And I think that ought to be the minimum demand for national security reasons, but also for consumer choice. Why shouldn't the consumer have a right to choose the fuel they want to use in a car that can use any kind of fuel? And the estimates I get consistently are the total extra price for the car is $100. Now, you look at all the other things the government mandates and all the other things the government requires, all of which add more than $100 cost, and then all of a sudden, this one area is the one where they're very slow to move. And I think that's because there are powerful interests on the other side who are afraid of competition, and they're afraid of letting the consumer have a clear and an open choice. The second question I want to raise, and I want to raise this intellectually and then move into a proposal that's pretty bold. I don't understand why the EPA took a long time to reach a conclusion in October that cars built after 2007 could use E15. And then EPA suddenly, in the next 3 months, reached this conclusion, the cars built since 2001 could use E15. Now, I've raised two questions about this. The first is, if it's true in January, why wasn't it true in October? I mean, what magic, I think they should be challenged to produce the documents to tell us what magic new thing occurred. Why was it they couldn't have said in October, oh yeah, there's no evidence, because the real problem here is which test do you use? Do you use the test you've proven it totally safe, or do you use the test you've proven it unsafe? And the fact is, I mean, and by the way, if you use the prove it's unsafe test, the Wright brothers would still not be flying. All great new innovations involve periods of change and turmoil and testing. And if you have a bureaucratic standard in Washington, D.C., of people who have no economic interest in the outcome, have no risk in the outcome, and they want to avoid any possible risk. This is true at the Food and Drug Administration. It's true at the Environmental Protection Agency. But I think now we should go back to and make the same test, which is, all right, and somebody should file a Freedom of Information Act request. Show us what test changed your mind between October and January, and now show us why exactly the same principles can't be applied to all cars. I mean, you don't want to get into a regime where there are three different pumps. It'll be too complicated, it'll be too confusing, and the average person won't get it. You want to go to a single regime based on safety, and that single regime clearly ought to be E15. And I have yet to see any evidence that it shouldn't be. I mean, nobody who testifies against it comes in with engineering tests. They come in with opinions normally based on interest groups. So I want to pose one of the things we are working on at American Solutions, and Steve Everly, who's here, is at the American Solutions booth behind you, is working on this, is to develop an environmental solutions agency to replace the Environmental Protection Agency. An environmental solutions agency would get up every morning and say, yes, you can do that if, and then they would set standards we have to meet, and they'd go out and try to find incentives to meet the standards. The Environmental Protection Agency gets up every morning and say, no, you can't do that because. And they are really, in many ways, hostile to all new technology, hostile to local community control, hostile to the business community, hostile to the marketplace. You know, and a couple years ago, how many of you remember 2 or 3 years ago when congressmen had to actually pass a provision, which they renew every year, that says the Environmental Protection Agency cannot look at methane production by cows? Do any of you remember this? There was literally a proposal. There was a study being done at the Environmental Protection Agency to see what the total volume of methane production by cows was. And I'm not going to talk about the common language that applies to how that methane is produced. But and as a historian, my first reaction was, okay, so how many bison were there at the peak of the great bison herds? And how much methane were they producing with no sign of global warming? And what kind of an urban academic bureaucrat would you have to be to say, oh gosh, let's look at cows as a major threat to the environment? And yet, that's what happens when you put people in offices in Washington and give them too much power and too little responsibility and allow them to gradually think that they must know everything and you must know nothing because you're out here and there. And so you end up in a system where if you actually live in a state, you probably don't have much control over what you're going to do because, after all, you're here. But if you got a job in Washington, you could not only control your state, you can control the other 49 states because now you're in Washington, so you know everything and the people back home know nothing. You with me so far? So I think we ought to have an environmental solutions agency that starts by cooperating with the 50 states that has a bias that says, you know, maybe the people of the states actually care about their environment because they actually live in it. Maybe they actually have a concern for finding common sense solutions. And maybe the bias ought to be to use science and technology and entrepreneurs and incentives to actually fix things rather than to use red tape and litigation and regulation to actually stop things. I think that's a very fundamental difference in how Americans historically have operated. And the truth is, incentives work, entrepreneurs work. Litigation and regulation is a very cumbersome and very ineffective method of trying to control a society that's this complex and this dynamic. If we had had federal government controls, Henry Ford could not have invented the mass-produced automobile, and the Wright brothers could not have invented flight. It's just that true. And so we need to go back and be practical and find ways to get things done. I think we can do it, and we have a very simple goal. Let's maximize the rate at which we develop new breakthroughs in biology. Let's maximize the rate at which we can bring those breakthroughs to productivity, whether it's in health, food, materials, technology, or energy. Let's maximize the rate at which rural America has an opportunity to create its own wealth, process its own products, develop its own incomes, so that Americans have the choice of living in small towns if they want, and living in rural America if they want, as well as living in big cities. There's no reason we can't design this kind of a very positive future. My hope for tonight, and I have to say, when the president sent out an email saying that he was going to his supporters, saying he was going to emphasize winning the future, I was delighted because I wrote a book called Winning the Future in 2007, and I was hoping it meant he had read my book and was going to have a number of ideas from it. And I'm going to watch the State of the Union tonight, and my newsletter tomorrow will compare my idea of winning the future with his, and we'll see whether or not he can get out of being trapped by left-wing ideology and actually have some pretty cool things. But I have one hope that relates to energy. I hope the president will say tonight that given the threats we have in national security, given the challenges we have in foreign indebtedness, given the need we have to create American jobs, that he is going to make American energy production a major centerpiece of our economic growth. He's going to focus on clearing away the red tape and the regulations and the restrictions and helping Americans produce their own energy, and that he is going to include renewable fuels and biological fuels as a significant component of that. If the president will focus on creating American energy, he will do as much to create jobs as any single thing he can do. And I think that he has an opportunity tonight, and I look forward to seeing whether or not he steps up to the plate and takes that opportunity. I look forward to working with you in getting this message about renewable fuels out to the whole country. And I'm delighted to have a chance to be here and be with my good friend Linda Uffmeyer. And it's a thrill to see her as the majority leader. And I'm delighted to be back and have a chance to work with Governor Branstad. So I think we have questions, so I'm going to look forward to it. Thank you very much.
We do have time for a couple of questions if folks want to go to the mics.
If I could. First of all, Mr. Gingrich, I'd like to just say may God continue to bless you. You're such a true American hero. You've done so many great things for our country. We're all indebted to you and your efforts. My name's Scott Flynn. I'm a businessman out of Sioux City, Iowa. I own a construction management firm. Have directed construction of several ethanol plants in Iowa. It's a fabulous industry. I get tired of seeing it getting a bloody nose in the press and on different things, and Monty does a great job of setting the record straight. But now that we own General Motors, we the people, my question to you is around what we can do to force General Motors to work on engine redesign. I'm a mechanical engineering grad from Iowa State. If they focus on engine redesign based on higher ethanol fuels, we can get better performance and then make ethanol the standard and the clear-cut winner for use in all across the country. So my question to you is, it's a hypothetical, if you were president of the United States someday, just maybe, what would you do to encourage all the automakers to focus on engine redesign for performance?
Well, I mean, I actually like the person who was here just before I got a chance to talk, who made me think that maybe the first thing you would do is you would call a meeting at the White House and ask the vice president of each of the companies for their Brazilian operations to come and visit with you and explain why engineering in Brazil seems to be so much easier than engineering in Detroit. I mean, this is what is such total hypocrisy. The fact is, all of these companies make cars in Brazil that are designed for a country which has decided to be energy independent. And guess what? Between ethanol and their new offshore discoveries, the Brazilians are going to be net exporters of energy. Now, why is it the Brazilians can figure this out and the United States government can't? And that's why the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency are hindering a better future. I mean, they are literally incompetent bureaucracies. And I think the president, he could do it tonight. I mean, he could challenge the auto companies to make the commitment, and there's a cycle time for retooling, but it's not that long, to make the commitment that by 2012 or 2013, they will match the efficiencies they already have in Brazil. And I think, frankly, the congressional committees ought to call hearings, and because this flex fuel issue is a national security issue. Being able to get off of Middle Eastern oil and being able to lower the worldwide price of oil is an important thing, because there's a real danger as the Chinese develop their own middle class. You're going to see a dramatic increase in pressure for energy. It's also true that as we build better technologies for biofuels, that they're going to empower Latin America and Africa to produce a lot more fuel at home and to keep a lot more money at home. And that's frankly good for very poor countries and helps very poor farmers start to develop a whole new way of life with a whole new cash economy they've never dreamed of before. So there are big foreign aid implications to this capacity to have flex fuel vehicles. But I wish the president would say tonight, you know, we would like to meet the Brazilians. And this is what's so crazy. You know, we're not talking about science fiction. We'd like to meet the Brazilian standard of flex fuel cars by 2013. Now, why should that be so impossible? And hearings where members of Congress said to the auto manufacturers, please come and explain to us why all of your really clever engineers are in Brazil and none of them seem to be here. And I just think it's indefensible.
I think we have time for one more over here.
Mr. Gingrich, I am a farmer. I've been a farmer for 69 years, and I have a question for you and the gentleman who spoke immediately before you. Don't you realize it's immoral to let farmers make any money?
Well, you know, I used to teach history a long time ago. And it's very funny because what I said, I think, starting about the 1880s, you have this continuous wave of populism. Because you have people under huge economic pressure. By the 1920s, we begin building these very complex farm programs to maintain farm income. We've worried for over 100 years now about rural America, economic income. We finally start figuring out some ways to actually make money, to create jobs that are rural, to have an entirely new decentralized industry that works, that has jobs that average above $40,000, that have 99%. In terms of Obama's interest, 99% of people who work in the ethanol industry have health care. You know, in many counties, it is either the second largest or the largest employer and the largest taxpayer. And you look at all that and you say to yourself, obviously, urban big newspapers would want to kill it because it's working. I mean, and you wonder, what are their values? I mean, why is it, and I'll close this, but it's important to remember, Reagan used to do this whole riff about if you took a loaf of bread and you tracked how many taxes from the land tax you pay to the gasoline tax to the tax on the tractor and so forth, and there were like 274 taxes in a loaf of bread. But when somebody talks about expensive food and they're talking about the quarter pounder with cheese you bought at a fast food place, or they're talking about the packaged processed food you bought at the grocery store, less than 20 cents out of a dollar comes from the farmer. And so how about the other 80 cents? And I just think this idea that somehow, and I thought the Wall Street Journal Saturday editorial was just plain flat intellectually wrong. I mean, it's not about ideology, just flat wrong. And I think people ought to at least, I don't mind people having an honest argument about ideology, but they ought to at least use facts that are accurate. In the morning that I see the folks who are worried about food and fuel worry about the cost of diesel fuel, worry about the cost of commodities on the world market, worry about the inflation the Federal Reserve is building into our system, all of which is going to show up as higher prices, worry about the inefficiencies of big corporations that manufacture and process food products. I mean, the morning they start doing that, I'll take them seriously. Until then, this is an interest group fight in which a number of very sophisticated big interest groups have set up a myth and are busy actively propagating the myth. But the truth is, it hurts the farmer, it hurts rural America, and it's fundamentally unfair to America's future.
I want to thank the speaker for being here today. You know, I'm a farm girl. I grew up on a farm. I raised my family on a farm, and I can't think of anybody that understands agriculture, rural issues any better than this man. And Mr. Speaker, I happen to know that you aren't going to make any decision about whether or not you might consider running for president until you and Calista discuss it more, and that will happen probably at the end of February or something like that. But I, for one, think this is just the right guy to be president of the United States, and I think there's a whole bunch of people in this room that believe that.
Thank you. Thank you, Speaker. Thank you very much. Very good. Thank you, Majority Leader Utmeyer and Speaker Gingrich.